Atrapi udharantimam.
Atrapi udharantimam.
Itihasam purata puratanam.
Itihasam puratanam.
Arshabhanam cha sambhadam.
Arshabhanam cha sambhadam.
Vedehashabhatmanha.
Vedehashabhatmanha.
Atrapi.
Atrapi.
Of describing Bhagavata Dharma.
Udaharanti
is given an example.
Imam.
This. Itihasham.
Historical account.
Puratanam. Ancient. Arshabhanam. Of the sons of Risha. Cha. And. Samudhana. The conversation. Vidihasha. With Janaka, king of Vidheva. Vidheva. Mahatmanaha. Who was a great broad-minded soul. Translation. To explain the devotional service of the Lord, sages have related the ancient history of the conversation between the great soul king Videha and sons of Risha. Translation responsibly. To explain the devotional service of the Lord.
To explain the devotional service of the Lord.
Sages have related the ancient history.
Sages have related the ancient history.
Of the conversation between.
Of the conversation
the great soul king Videha. And the sons of Risha.
And the sons of Risha.
The four by the disciples of Srila Prabhupada. The words Itihasha Puratanam, meaning the ancient historical account, are significant here. Srimad Bhagavatam is Nirgama Kalpa Thuru Kalitap Alam, the ripened fruit of the desire tree of Vedic knowledge. In the pages of the Bhagavatam, we find true historical narrations relating to the Supreme Personality of Godhead and the liberation of conditioned souls. These historical accounts are not fictional or mythology, but describe the wonderful activities of the Lord and his devotees that took place in the yugas previous to the advent of this puny yuga. Although mundane scholars have foolishly tried to depict the Bhagavatam as a mythological work or a recent creation, the actual fact is that Srimad Bhagavatam is a perfect transcendental literature describing not only the entire situation of this universe, but also that which lies far beyond this universe, in both the material and spiritual skies. If one seriously studies the Srimad Bhagavatam, he becomes the most learned intellectual man. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu desired that all pious persons become highly learned by hearing the Srimad Bhagavatam, and then preaching the glories of the Lord in a scientific way all over the world. It is essential that we hear these historical narrations, such as the conversations between the Navayogendras and King Videha, with complete faith and submission. Then, as stated in verse 12 of this chapter, even if our former life is filled with abominable activities, simply by hearing the Srimad Bhagavatam, we will be promoted to the same transcendental status as the Lord and his pure devotees. This is the extraordinary power of the Bhagavatam history, as contrast with the useless, mundane historical accounts which ultimately serve no purpose. Although mundane historians justify their work on the plea that we have to learn from history, we can practically see that the world situation is now rapidly deteriorating into an unbearable conflict and chaos, while so-called historians stand helplessly by. But the Bhagavad historians, who have faithfully heard Srimad Bhagavatam, can give a perfect and potent instruction for the restoration of a peaceful and blissful world. Therefore, those who are inclined to enrich their intellectual life through the study of history should educate themselves in the historical narrations of Srimad Bhagavatam. This will bring them the perfection of intellectual and spiritual life. Omagyan Timiranda Shyaganjana Savatya Chakshuramidikamina Krishna Sri Guruvyamaha Namo Om Vishnu Badaya Krishna Vastaya Vitalashi Madhivradayananda Goswami Namane. Namo Vishnu Padaya Krishna Vasaya Vittalesha Mujibhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Nomine Namaste Saraswati Devam Gaudavani Vacharani Namaste Sushunivadi Pashatara Vashatarani. So, they say history is written by the victors of a particular situation. So history can be misconstrued. Recently, on a material sort of thing, the Prabhupada saying, the Port is saying that mundane historians justify their work on the plea that we have to learn from history. So generally, it's the victory in a conflict or something that makes the history. Recently, I came across some interesting facts. Generally, it is understood that back in the 15th century, there was the Renaissance. You know, and there was great upheaval coming out of the Dark Ages, and mankind was enlightened with different understandings, going back to the classics and so on and so forth. And this was all, you know, you had people like Da Vinci, Michelangelo, Raphael, different, you know, thoughts of high standing. And recently it was thought of that this was just something that was generated by the evolution of Western civilization. But in actual fact, what was one of the major reasons why there was such a change in human society, there's just such an upliftment in knowledge, was the fact that actually the Chinese, who were materially much more advanced than Western civilization, who had kept themselves apart from Western civilization, because they felt that the Europeans were barbarians, they didn't want anything to do with them at all because they were so fallen. Ironically, that's what the Westerners were thinking about the Asian countries, but actually China was very, very advanced, already understanding the laws of flight. They were using balloons and kites and so forth, which was, in Western technology and science, was attributed to Da Vinci coming up with these wonderful creations of flight. You ever saw those drawings of Da Vinci? Well, actually, what happened was, in the 15th century, I think it was the 15th or late 14th, an emperor of China actually sent an armada, a fleet of his men, with all their technology and everything, to Europe. And they were welcomed by the kings and leaders of the European culture. And these Chinese people gave their dissemination of their knowledge of how to use fireworks and all this kind of thing, you know, different technologies, which it wasn't recorded in any European history whatsoever, you know. So they felt it better, hey, hang on, we can't learn anything from these Chinese, we can't have it written down that we actually got all this information from Chinese. And actually, the documentation that they brought with them enabled Da Vinci to actually think up and expand on his theories of flight and warfare, you know, who drew those cannons and tanks and all that kind of stuff. So it all came from the Chinese. In more recent history, again, something that is completely covered up and not taught, is that, you know how in the world there were so many different atrocities, genocide. We know of genocides in Cambodia, we know of the genocide during World War II where the Jewish people were executed. So many different areas of genocide, but one of the major genocides that happened in the last century was a genocide that happened in Indonesia. Indonesia, you say? What happened in Indonesia? Nearly 3 million people, approximately 3 million people were killed, murdered. And it's one of the most covered up genocides of all time. And this was done because it was our side that was doing the killing, or supporting it. At that stage, Indonesia was oppressed or governed by communism. And there was a regime that took over the communist system, and to purify the situation, they would kill the communists. And so this was actually suppressed. Nobody really knew this as history. So history is made by historians who have a bent, who have a way of thinking, well, this is better for our culture that we don't say anything about this, so we won't mention it in history. But the Bhagavatam tells it as it is, and tells the living entities from all walks of life how to develop one's God consciousness, and the ultimate journey is to go back home. And through the stories of these great kings and rishis and mahatmas, we actually learn how to develop our life and go to the ultimate goal of going back home. Now it's mentioned here that mundane scholars have foolishly tried to depict the Bhagavatam as a mythological work or a recent creation. So at the turn of the 19th century, these English, or I think they were English, Indic scholars tried to ascertain the date when the Bhagavatam was created. And what they surmised, and they spread this speculation, that actually a grammarian called Bhopadev, a 16th century character, actually created the Bhagavatam, that he wrote it down. And the reason why they gave this, so this was 600 years before them, so it was in the 13th century, that he was the one that actually wrote the Bhagavatam, and it wasn't something that went back into antiquity, you know, 5,000 years ago. No, it was this guy wrote it 600 years ago, Bhopadev. And the argument was that the writing of the Bhagavatam was just too intelligent, too clearly written, too precise, that anybody back then, 5,000 years ago, just wouldn't have the intelligence to write something like the Bhagavatam. So this Bhopadev, when actually we study his, and David Mrisaswami has done his research on this, we find out that actually this author, this Bhopadev, was a compiler of the Bhagavatam verses, and actually tried to get the essence of the Bhagavatam by compiling different verses. It wasn't that he composed them, but he actually used them to glorify the Vaishnavas and to glorify Krishna. And one of the treatises that he actually wrote was called the Hari Lila. So it was the pastimes of Krishna, which he derived from the Bhagavatam. So this date as to when the Bhagavatam was actually created is confusing to the non-devotees. But the devotees take the Acharya as their example and follow in their tradition and take fully and have full faith in the Bhagavatam, in that it's a continuous story that goes back thousands of years and is there to help us in our Krishna consciousness. One of the main points that was mentioned in this purport was that if one seriously studies the Srimad Bhagavatam, he becomes the most learned intellectual person. And this was Lord Chaitanya's desire, that all pious people become highly learned by hearing Srimad Bhagavatam and then preach the glories of the Lord in a scientific way all over the world. So what we have to do as devotees, we have to actually take this instruction that Lord Chaitanya is giving us, that we have to present Bhagavatam in a way that people can understand and relate to. We have to become very diligent. We have to take it as the instruction of our spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada. This is what Srila Prabhupada wanted us to do. Srila Prabhupada, it was actually Srila Prabhupada's sannyas anniversary. So Srila Prabhupada was given the instruction by his Guru Maharaj to actually present Krishna consciousness of Bhagavatam to the Western world. This was his mission. Now, prior to Srila Prabhupada meeting his Guru Maharaj, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, he was involved in the Gandhi movement. He was not interested externally. He was not interested in any of the sages and that sort of thing. He lived a pious life, but he wasn't interested. He said he saw too much of the different gurus and swamis coming to his father's home, so he wasn't that interested. And when he heard about Gandhi, he became one of the major, or he became interested in the whole Gandhi movement. Then as a young man, he had the opportunity to meet Bhaktisiddhanta. And on the very first meeting of Srila Prabhupada with Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj, Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj told him, "You are an intelligent young man. You should teach this Bhagavad Dharma to the Western countries, and that will be you will be very successful." So this was at the very first time he got an instruction from his Guru Maharaj right there and then. And Prabhupada, understanding the gravity of this, straight away took that to heart. Completely forgot about Gandhi, became fully absorbed in this instruction that was given to him by his Guru Maharaj. So we as disciples of Srila Prabhupada are often hankering when will our spiritual master give us what he wants me to do? But Prabhupada then went on to become a manager of a chemical factory for a great intellectual in India, Chandra Bose. And then when he was in, I think it was Nagpur, where he set up a little ashram type of thing for visiting sannyasis and preachers of the Gaudiya Math. And it was told to Bhaktisiddhanta that this Abhay Charanday was actually a very, very pious, good devotee, and that we can stay at his house and preach from his house. And so he accommodated the devotees very much. And he was initiated in 1933. And again, then he wrote a letter to his Guru Maharaj saying, Guru Maharaj, I'm just a grihastha. I'm working, you know, I'm not doing that much, you know. These brahmacharis are just so full on, they're doing so much service, they're distributing so much, and I'm just a lowly grihastha, you know, how can I serve you? And Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj again gave him exactly the same instruction that he gave back in 1922, is that you're an intelligent man. Preach his Krishna consciousness, preach his Bhagavatam to a Western world. This is my instruction. And that was actually the last instruction that Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur Maharaj gave to Srila Prabhupada before he passed away. Previously, also at Radhakund, there was also this time that Bhaktisiddhanta gave this instruction to Prabhupada, met Bhaktisiddhanta at Radhakund. And at that stage, Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj was really disturbed about the infighting that was happening within his mat, and that they had just received a new temple, and everybody was fighting for which room they would go in, and all that kind of stuff. And Prabhupada, and he said to Prabhupada, if ever you get money, print books. Because the books, he said, if I could, I'd take all the marble off the temple room walls, sell it, and the money will be used for printing books. So this was Prabhupada's mission in life. And it's not like if Prabhupada, straight away, after Radhakund, or after in 1933, he took on this instruction wholeheartedly. It took 43 years to eventually hop on the Jaladut and sail to the Western world. All this time was a lifetime in preparation, preparing, always having the desire of his having clear in his mind what the instruction was of his Guru Maharaj, that I have to serve in this way, I have to go to the Western world, I have to allow this my Guru Maharaj's desire to fructify to happen. And so it was 43 years later that actually he took the challenge and took this Bhagavad Dharma to the Western world. And then when he arrived, we all read Lilamrita. You know, he arrived and he really didn't know, well, where do I go now? I can go right or I can go left. So Prabhupada always had faith that Krishna was directing him and that the Bhagavad would be presented to whoever. And Prabhupada always kept on translating. Always kept on translating the Bhagavatam. Always writing his purports. To the extent that when he first came to the Western world, he had some young men helping him. And one was Hayagriva, who had some diploma in English literature, I think it was. And he offered his services to Srila Prabhupada. He said, Prabhupada, can I help you in some way? And Prabhupada said, yeah, could you edit my work for me? And Hayagriva thus said, yeah, I could probably do that, yeah. And thinking that Prabhupada had some little book or something, you know, some little thing that he might be able to help in editing. And so Prabhupada said, oh, very good. And he went to his trunk and he pulled out a manuscript that was like this, you know, a big, thick manuscript. And he said, here we go. Can you edit this? You know, wow. And so Prabhupada was really overawed by it. Hayagriva was actually really overawed by the fact that, wow, I've got to transcribe this, I've got to edit this manuscript. And the manuscript was actually voluminous. It was huge. It was the Bhagavad Gita. And so he was surprised by that, and then Prabhupada said, oh, and when you finish that, perhaps you can do some more. And Hayagriva said, yeah, what else have you got? And so he opened up his trunk, and there was a trunk full of manuscripts. So it was a lifetime of work there for Hagrid. So this was, Prabhupada was always editing, was always writing, translating the Bhagavatam. And it was for us. And Prabhupada was often asked, about his guru's order. You know, this was, he was doing this, he was presenting this Bhagavatam because his guru had asked him to do it. This was the instruction of his guru Maharaj. And one time he said, what he is desiring, I'm trying a little bit, and you are helping me, so I have to thank you more. Prabhupada was saying this. So Prabhupada actually was saying that you are directly the representatives of my Guru Maharaj, and you are helping me in fulfilling my desire, fulfilling my Guru Maharaj's desire by presenting this Bhagavatam to the Western world. You're helping me. And he was incredibly grateful, and at that stage it's one of the rare occasions that Srila Prabhupada cried, because he was so grateful that all his disciples were actually helping him fulfill the desire that his Guru Maharaj had. That's how strong Prabhupada felt about this mission that had been given to him in presenting the Bhagavatam. So, this gratitude of Srila Prabhupada is actually a blessing. You know how you have different yoga groups and they give blessings, you know? The guru will say, giving them a blessing, or you have somebody can get darshan and they'll get a hug of the guru, and so on and so forth. You know, it's a big thing at the moment. Hugging is a big thing. But real gratitude comes by getting the blessing of your Guru Maharaj and helping him in his service for his Guru Maharaj. That's where the blessing comes. So this also, for example, we do our service, and we have, and we understand that actually we're all servants of Srila Prabhupada. Prabhupada and his purports brought this Bhagavatam to the Western world. This information in this Bhagavatam, which is not different to Krishna, can alleviate the suffering of all living entities. As it's said here, therefore those who are inclined to enrich their intellectual life through the study of this history, this Bhagavatam, should educate themselves in the historical narrations. This will bring them the perfection of intellectual life and spiritual life. Perfection. This will lead you to perfection. So this is the legacy that Prabhupada has left for us, to help him to distribute and to disseminate this knowledge. So every now and again we need to get the blessings of Guru. And Bhakti and I are disciples of Hridayananda Maharaj. And we do service to Krishna in various ways. Our spiritual master allows us to do the service we're doing. If we write, okay, listen, I'm managing Gopals now, and I'm doing this and that, we've got our Vaishnava Sangha programs, and I'm teaching meditation. Hridayananda Maharaj is right, oh, this is very nice. Keep it up. Very good, very satisfied. You are helping in the mission of Srila Prabhupada. Just by understanding that we're helping in the mission of Srila Prabhupada, that's the blessing of Prabhupada. As long as I'm doing the message, helping present the message of Bhagavatam to the former conditioned souls, I'm helping Prabhupada. And by helping Prabhupada in service, we get his blessing. So, this presenting of the Bhagavatam for Srila Prabhupada is a family business. And family business has to stay united, has to be completely linked. And we have to have the right mood of learning and appreciation. There's no disunity. There can't be any disunity within the family. When there's disunity in the family, it's totally upsetting. If somebody is not right in the family, it just disturbs the whole family. So we have to have this understanding, this consciousness, that by performing the service of presenting Bhagavatam all over the world, we have to be family members, Prabhupada's family members. No disunity. As I was saying, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's time, there was disunity, real disunity. And we also, within the early days of ISKCON, when Prabhupada had left the planet, there was some disunity. But now we see more and more that there is a unity coming, a maturity. Because, you know, as we grow older, you know, when we were kids in the family, you know, you'd be fighting your little sister, or your little sister would be throwing rocks at you, and so on and so forth. But then as we grew older, you became friends with your sister, and in maturity you had a more congenial, united sort of family, supporting the parents. I remember in our life, you know, if there were financial difficulties, the kids would get some work and they would go and contribute to the family coffers and helping the parents and so on and so forth. So there was unity. So it's imperative that there's unity in our family, in Prabhupada. This is our real family, by the way. We have a material family, and we've had hundreds of thousands of different material families. This is our real spiritual family. So the foremost thing is that we have to actually be very united, not disunited. Sometimes, when this disunity comes into it, it's a little unfortunate. Sometimes there are different philosophies that come about, which cause a little bit of disturbance for people. We're living in a strange age. Sometimes you have it that, you know how when in every age the younger generation is often thought of, boy, they're not the way they used to be in the old days, you know. Kids nowadays are just something else, you know. And they have the same thing with the Y generation and so on and so forth. The kids are not following as nicely as they should. They're being a lot more disrespectful and so on and so forth. This is documented. But psychologists have actually shown that in this age, actually it's more prominent than in any other age. There's a lack of authority. People don't really give two hoots about authorities. Young people I'm talking about. I mean, so often you hear in the newspapers, you know, a person will swing a party and there's hundreds of people coming, you know, and there's like a riot. They destroy neighbours' properties and so on and so forth. And then when the police come, they are absolutely belligerent to the police. They don't care. Oh, you anyway, you know. In our time, if we were up to some nonsense and the police would come, we'd be like, oh God, cops are here. And everybody would be like, oh God. You know, like I got caught. Somebody snapped me. I was a tall boy, so I could easily get into a pub and not proclaim my age. And so I remember specifically I was in the Dandenong pub, the Southern Aurora, I think it was called. And I was having a drink with a few mates. I thought this was great, 17 years old, 16 and a half or something. And I'm in the pub with the big boys, you know. Anyway, the cops came in, you know. You, how old are you? Complete panic, you know. And I remember that the policeman gave me a swift kick up the backside. And I was out, but I never ever went back to the pub until I was 18 years old. Nowadays, people are a lot more belligerent. And psychologists have put this down to the liberal age that we were living in the 80s and 90s. The men and women of that age have a guilt complex with their children. Because they are actually given so much freedom, and there's a need for the man and woman nowadays to go out and work and earn a living. So what the parents did was, they would put their kid in child mining. It's still the case. They put their kid in child mining instead of staying home with mum. And this is forced upon them due to society and pressures, economic pressures, that both parents have to work. When both parents have to work, there's a double income coming in. Because mum isn't there with the children, mum and dad feel guilty that they had to put this child in daycare. And so what happens is, because they've got a double income, they give the kid anything the kid wants. I mean, when I had a birthday, if I got a small present, I was overawed, you know, or a train set or something like that. But now, I mean, it's an iPod. Oh, what do you want, an iPod? Oh, you want the latest, you know, this thing, that thing? Latest Game Boy, whatever. You have it. Because they want their love. Because they're thinking, I haven't been a good parent because I put them into childcare, I'm not there for them, and so on and so forth. This is actually a worldwide phenomenon. And because they've got the money to do it, they do it. The other thing that happens is that because the parents aren't there, and they're not there on a continuous basis, the child is left on its own devices, and even though a person is looking after them in a daycare centre, it's not like a mum who can be a disciplinarian, and you know, because the daycare person, there's no way that you can touch a child or reprimand them, or if it's in this child abuse, you know. So they're getting away with blue murder at times. This is a generalization, but it's a phenomenon that psychologists are seeing in the world today. The children are less inclined to take authority or to take anything. So basically what happens is these young people go out to the workforce, and in the workforce they have a social structure, a hierarchical structure. You know, there's the boss, there's the manager and so on. But these young people in the workforce just think, hey, I know better than this old bloke. What does he know anyway? You know, we know better, we can do things better. You know, these old guys don't know anything. We got the clues. And there's no respect for authorities. So sometimes this creeps into devotional service. Sometimes. And that has to be really checked. That has to be really checked. It's something that we have to be really mindful of, that we don't allow it. Because that's not the procedure. We know through Vaishnava etiquette that we have to give proper respect to the older devotees. And sometimes people wonder, you know, well, why, you know, when we're handing the flowers around, why do you go to him first? Why don't we just, you know, because he's an older devotee. What constitutes an older devotee? The younger devotee may think, oh yeah, but I've read the Bhagavad Gita, I know what's in here, you know. But an older devotee has read it and has a longevity of time to actually figure it out, figure the message of Bhagavatam in their own life. Experiential. Understanding what's been taught by these great sages and different Mahatmas within this Bhagavatam. What's being said, and adapting it to their own life. What's been said in regards to the worship of the deity. What's been said in different aspects of life, how to run different programs. So this younger generation has to be mindful, and it takes a bit of a paradigm shift to actually accept some authority and say, hey, hang on a second. And even we see, when we first came to Krishna consciousness was so new, and even if a person was 1 year or 6 months older than the person coming to Krishna consciousness, it was like, oh Prabhu, what can you tell me? It's like, as if they had the fountainhead of knowledge, you know. And we were in awe of anybody that was like older, 6 months. God, he's been in the movement 6 months. Wow, a year. Wow, you know. Because of that experiential knowledge. Experience in Krishna consciousness. Real living with the Bhagavatam and enacting the Bhagavatam within your life is such a valuable thing. That's why throughout the Vedic history, we very much respect the senior devotees. And it's incumbent upon us to actually really, really be mindful of that and really work that into our lives, that we become very respectful, because the older devotee has the experience of Bhagavad Gita, has the experience of knowledge. Now, a lot of people say, well, you know, you can't teach an old dog new tricks. You know, they say that. If you're old, you know, he's just set in his ways, man, you can't. He hasn't got a clue, you know. He can't progress. But actually, this was an older thinking, and you as a doctor Mahatma would know this, that originally it was thought that the brain, the mechanisms of the brain, were like a machine. They were a mechanism. They were this compartment, that compartment, so on and so forth. Recent scientific studies understand that the brain is actually has neuroplasticity, which means it's very flexible. One part of the brain can adapt to another part of the brain. You can actually cut out a piece of the brain that was perhaps responsible for the movement of a particular limb or something. What happens is you may cut that piece out of the brain. The brain will learn how to utilize that limb on another part of the brain. So it's now understood that actually the brain is flexible. It's very, very fluid. It's very, very, has a great ability to keep on learning. Sometimes a person said, well, the greatest part of your learning is in your early informative years, in your baby years. That's true. because there's an incredible need for the brain to learn as much as possible in those to survive. But then when a person reaches maturity or middle age or something, it says, oh no, doesn't learn anymore. That's not true. We can learn all the time. We can increase our knowledge all the time. If we have the desire, if we have the dedication and the strength to actually pursue it, if we have the intensity to learn more. Now what's being pointed out here is that the Bhagavad Gita has the message of teaching Bhagavad Gita has the greatest urgency. And Prabhupada is saying here, you know, please, you help me in this mission. You are the representatives of my Guru Maharaj. You please help me in my mission. So as it's said here, we have to educate ourselves in the historical narrations of the Srimad Bhagavatam. We have to become intellectual persons, become the most learned intellectual persons. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu desired that all pious people become highly learned by hearing Srimad Bhagavatam. Now, just one section to point this out just a little bit further is in one of the most important verses of Bhagavad Gita, 10:10. Tesham satatam yuktanam vajitam pratipurvakaham tadami buddhi yogam tam yenam amupajanti tam. In the last part of that purport, Prabhupada says, a person may have a bona fide spiritual master and be attached to a spiritual organization, but still, if he is not intelligent enough to make progress, then Krishna from within gives him instruction so that he may ultimately come to him without difficulty. The qualification is that a person always engage himself in Krishna consciousness with love and devotion, render all kinds of services. He should perform some sort of work for Krishna, some sort of work for Krishna. And that work should be with love. Again, Prabhupada puts that in. We should serve with love. We should do our progress at work with love. If a devotee is intelligent enough, he will make progress on the path of self-realization. If one is sincere and devoted to the activities of devotional service to the Lord, will give a chance to make progress and ultimately attain Him. So we have to think of ways, and this is again the start of this Bhagavatam, we have to think of ways to present Bhagavatam in all manners of ways. And that's where we have to think, okay, how can we develop, how can we preach, how can we help Srila Prabhupada deliver this message of Bhagavatam to the fallen conditioned souls that are out there in the material world? And it can be done in so many different ways. But sometimes if we have a material thinking, oh, I'm 60 years old, or I'm 55, or I'm 78, or whatever, I can't, or I'm 24, oh, I can't do any more, I've done as much as I can, I'll just be like this, you know. I'll just stay here, I'll just do my service at the temple. No, we have to stimulate our intelligence. We have to constantly think, how can I do a little bit more? I know that there are devotees who are mature devotees who are studying Mandarin. Now, for all intents and purposes, that could be a mundane thing, but not for the devotee. They're studying Mandarin for a specific purpose, to present this Bhagavatam to the Chinese nation. Of a billion people ready to receive this Bhagavatam. And after talking to some of the devotees that have been preaching in China, you see how enthusiastic the Chinese people are to have this knowledge. It's like they're a sponge. They're ready to absorb. They're ready to take anything, because it is the ultimate knowledge. It's the fulfillment of knowledge. It's the path to self-realization. So we have devotees that are learning Mandarin, just so they can preach in China. And there are other devotees that are studying in different other fields. Some are studying counselling. Some are studying in quantum physics. Now, I mean, one of the things that I'm interested in is preaching in areas of interreligious study. It's a huge thing at the moment. We've got an interfaith festival that's happening in Rye in November. And this is one of the first times that the devotees are going to be represented at this interfaith. We understand that everybody is striving towards God consciousness, and in an open-minded way, we're going to also be there. And be there to pick up those souls that are not satisfied with their material situation at the present stage, or their spiritual situation, and want to advance a little bit further, and are getting ready for Bhagavad Gita. So we're doing this interfaith thing, and in this interfaith festival, we're going to have, number one, first and foremost, a prasadam stall. Prasadam opens the heart. We're going to have a bookstall and a question and answer stall. And the Muslims are going to be there, and the Catholics are going to be there, and the born-agains are going to be there, and the Jewish are going to be there, but we're also going to be there. We're actually part, for want of a better word, we're representing the Hindu community. But actually, we know why we're there. We're presenting. We're there because Prabhupada wants us to be there. We're presenting Prabhupada. So anyway, and we've got an opportunity to do a lecture, and we've got an opportunity to do a kirtan. And, you know, this way we'll pick up those people that are inquisitive just that little bit more. Recently at Gopal's we had a group of boys come in, high school kids, from St. Kevin's Catholic School. Very well-to-do Catholic school, and they came and had prasadam, and they loved prasadam. We had macaroni and cheese, and they, you know, whoa, this is really great, they really loved it. Anyway, one boy came up to me, and he said, oh, I really love the food, it's really great. And I said, yeah, he's from St. Kevin's, we used to play footy against you. I said, what do you mean? He said, I was educated at Christian Brothers College as well, and we used to play footy against, from Sandyong, we used to play against St. Kevin's. Really? You were a Catholic? I said, yeah. Yeah. He said, what made you change from this becoming a Hari? I said, well, look, we could have a long conversation about it, but basically speaking, I wasn't satisfied in the teachings that they were presenting as Lord Jesus' teachings. I didn't believe that this was true. And I said, I was very, very determined to find spiritual life, to the extent where I even went to New Guinea to become a priest and a brother. But when I got there, I was just bombarded by the hypocrisy that I saw. He goes, yeah. And I said, so this philosophy that they were teaching wasn't satisfying. So I started looking, and I said, I found the truth in the Srimad Bhagavatam. He said, really? And he said, because I'm feeling a bit the same. And he said, would you mind if I give you my email address that we have a talk a little further about this? And he said, my friend and I are going to India at the end of this year. Perhaps you can give some good direction as to where we can stay in India. I said, yes, I think we might be able to help. Yeah. Very young man, very nice young man. So we're helping them to come to the point of Bhagavatam. So this is really important. The other area that I'm really interested in is, and it mentions here that a person then preaches, here it is here, all pious persons become highly learned in hearing Srimad Bhagavatam and then preach the glories of the Lord in a scientific way all over the world. Scientific way. At the moment, and this is another area that I'm really fascinated in, and for an artist, for a creative, arty-barty sort of person, to study science or to study anything to do with mathematics and science is just like, oh God. But with this understanding that the brain is flexible, it's neuroplasticity, I can learn this stuff. What I'm interested in, and what I've been, somehow or other, by Krishna's arrangement, I've been given this series of lectures and books on quantum physics, quantum mechanics. Fascinating. At this point of at this point of time in the scientific world, they are getting so close to actually understanding that there is a Supreme Person. With quantum physics now, the understanding that there is actually a unifying field that governs everything. It's a fascinating subject matter. For a devotee to actually study this, it's just like, wow. They have everything except
Krishna.
they got it down, you know. And scientifically it can now be proven that actually we're all one, you know. But we know, as Lord Chaitanya said, yeah, you're one, but you're different. You know? So we have to come into this knowledge, learn it very well, to be able to speak with intelligent people. Now this information about quantum physics is out there to the general community. It's out there. And we as preachers of Krishna consciousness will come in contact with that. No doubt about it. Sometime in our preaching, someone will come up and say, yeah, but actually, the unified field, the Planck's position is that everything is actually one, and that we're actually one consciousness, you know. And they know that on the level of the finest level of quantum physics, the finest level of material existence, things aren't directed by a material action, they're actually directed by consciousness, by vibration. It's fascinating stuff. And so they think, no, but you're one, you know. So where does it say that, how can you prove that actually there is still also the Supreme on top of that? If we are the Supreme, because they're saying out now, we're God. Which they've been saying for centuries, the Mayavadis have been saying for centuries. But now the scientific world is coming to this understanding as well. So this quantum physics is really, really interesting. And so I'm forced in a sense, being a right brain sort of type of person, you know, all creative and colour and wow, man, all that kind of stuff, to be more of a scientific sort of person, you know, having to study this quantum physics. So this is really exceptional, really interesting. But we can do it because the acharyas are showing the way, you know. We just recently had the appearance day of Bhaktivinoda Thakur. He's my hero because he's a grihastha and he does so much preaching and he's so strong. You know, I just love Bhaktivinoda Thakur, you know. But he's an example. And when Jagannath Ram was reading his pastimes, you know, the things he did, it was just amazing. And what was said there was that actually we can't imitate what he does. No, we can't. But we can take an example. He is an acharya. Acharya means he is an example. That we can also put more effort into our preaching. Everything he did for the preaching of Krishna consciousness. So we also have to develop that, you know, we have to see that consciousness. What more can I do? Don't be complacent with just our little lot. What more can I do? How much more can I fit in my day and not blow myself out completely, but how much can I do in the day to actually learn more, to study more, to be able to present Srimad Bhagavatam even better and more effectively and stronger. So, this is helping Srila Prabhupada to serve his spiritual master and get the blessings of his divine grace, Srila Prabhupada. Now the point that was mentioned here is that was mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita, Prabhupada made this point, that we have to do it, our service, in love. If we do our service in love, what happens? We're happy. We're happy. If somebody, even in a mundane world, if you fall in love with someone, you know, one of your mates finds a new girlfriend or something, you know, even now we come across, oh, I found this new chick, he's just in love with her, you know, and they're filled with love. So in the same way, if we fall in love with Krishna and do our work for Krishna, we'll be happy, not morose. Sometimes we see devotees have a morose tendency. They go into a morose sort of consciousness. If that's the case, and you understand that that's the case, that you're not feeling happy in your devotional service, then what you have to do is you have to seek out, again, that person that's had a little bit more experience, an older person, and seek their advice as to how they can help you out of that melee and out of that consciousness to again become happy in your service and again re-establish your love for Krishna, you know? And that is the role of the older devotee. Because of experience, they've been through that. They've been through the ups and downs of devotional service and can help you if you allow them to help you. And so you reveal your mind in confidence. And it should be in confidence. And so by having that, you find great solace because they're putting you back on the path. Now you've got your Guru Maharaj, but it can also be other devotees that you're associating with. Because they've read the Bhagavatam and they're adapting it in their life and they're able to help you. So it's very, very important. You know, it's very important. If you are consciously feeling unhappy in some ways that in your service, then there can be some adjustments made. You know?
And no one wants to see another devotee unhappy. No one wants to see. Prabhupada had this one occasion where his servant, you know, got into this melee of being unhappy. He was morose. And Prabhupada said, "What is this moroseness? Why are you constantly morose? Go home to your mother." He couldn't stand to be near that person. It's very difficult to be around a person that's morose, that's unhappy. Because we are affected. We affect each other's consciousness. So if a person's up, so you have to find out, how can I stay happy? How am I happy in my service? Am I happy in my service? If the service is not right for you, make some other adjustment. But you have to be happy in your devotion. Because the devotional service, your work for Krishna, has to be done in love. And when there's love, there's contentment and there's happiness. So this is the reason. I just thought I'd mention a couple of those points as far as respecting senior devotees and working with them and allowing them to help you. You know, because that is the role. We're all helping each other and we're all part of a unified family that can help each other progress in Krishna consciousness and push each other up. You know, Hare Krishna, who used to give that analogy, is the ladder, you know. We push the other one up all the time. You know, as we go up the rungs, we help the other one up, next one up, help one up. So we have to do that. It's a long haul, but we are all brothers and sisters, and we have to work together to help each other. And we do it in the spirit of respect, and we do it in a spirit of gratitude and appreciation of one another. And in that way, we'll actually fulfill the desire of Srila Prabhupada and present this Bhagavatam all over the world. We have a mission that is huge. The world is our field. We have so much preaching to do. You know it. When you go out there and you distribute books, you know it. There are people ripe for the picking. They're just wanting to have that final information. And we can give it. You're the representative. We have to understand what we've got, what we've been given. I mean, like I said, I've been reading these things on this quantum mechanics. These are big, big scientists, big, big materialists, very intellectual people. Boring as all hell. So morose. They have no idea. You know? And here, you know, we are young men and women. Well, young. Men and women. I still see myself as a 25-year-old kid that joined the Haris. But anyway, men and women that have got the greatest truth and are willing to spread it all over the world to help Srila Prabhupada in his mission. So I'll stop here. Has anybody got any comments or questions? Yes, Ruben?
We feel Prabhupada coming to the West was one of his main reasons to defeat the scientists so they wouldn't receive the general populace?
Don't think it was. No, Prabhupada's move was never one of defeating anybody. You know? Prabhupada's understanding and Prabhupada's mission was always to enlighten people. He never rejected any philosophy, he never rejected other religions, he didn't reject the scientists. He said, he actually... You alright, Prabhupada?
Okay.
Legs gone to sleep?
Yeah.
Prabhupada actually was always really supportive. And he actually said, I haven't read all these scientists. When he was giving that conversation to...
Bhakti Swarupa.
Who was it? Bhakti Swarupa Maharaj. Life comes from life. That conversation on the beach. He said, I'm not that well versed in the science of this world. I'll leave that up to you. You know? He's given the groundwork. We have to now develop it. So, he was never... I mean, he often said those rational scientists and so on and so forth. But he didn't come out to defeat anybody. He came to enlighten.
Mm-hmm. You know? Something that happens to that person, that was known for defeating the Buddhists.
Yeah, but even that, if you actually analyse it, I mean, it wasn't defeating, it was, again, the mood of a Vaishnava is to uplift, not to bring down. So that's the same with us. We'll come in contact with Buddhists, we'll come in contact with Mayavadis. Like, say, for example, in this interfaith thing, you know, I'm dealing with Mayavadis.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But I'm not going, to give them my association for what that's worth, you know what I mean? Not take his association. So Prabhupada was also like that. When he was teaching in the early days at the ashram of Dr. Mishra, was Dr. Mishra the early, you know?
Yeah.
He let him do his thing, and then afterwards Prabhupada would give a discourse on Bhagavad Gita as it is, you know. So in the same way, we don't bring people down, we want to uplift people. And so within...
They're feeding someone philosophically, bringing them down?
No, you have to do it in such a way as to actually encourage them, you know. And if all else fails, give them prasadam.
Because if they're presenting a nonsense philosophy, they need to...
Yeah. You have to state, you have to be strong, you have to state the case. But then it's not also, like also, you know, like you have the situation, if we're doing book distribution, you get the born again Christian, who is like completely one focus, Jesus is, do you accept Jesus? You know, yeah, well, you accept Jesus. No, do you accept Jesus as God? Well, you know, and I mean, sometimes you find it really hard to argue with those people, so you just have to let them be. There's no need to, you know, go all out and I have to defeat this person in a logical argument. I mean, if they're not able to be, if they haven't got a surrendered sort of part where they're willing to learn, you're really not doing yourself justice by wasting your time on that person at that stage, you know. So you just give them some prasadam. You know, the fact that they've had some association, as is pointed out in the previous verses here, just a moment's association with the person that's presenting Bhagavatam is enough for them. So just by them being in your association as a representative of Srila Prabhupada is enough for them. But you have to make it that, okay, you present your case, they're not willing to accept it, leave on friendly terms. You know? Not that you go, hey, you dirty Mayavadi, you walk off, oh, you carbon demon, or you're crazy Christian. No. Thanks for having a conversation with you, you know. That was really uplifting. You're a very nice person. You know? Like that. I remember the old days, back in the old days, Bhavananda had that down. You know, again, I guess I'm drawing back to what happened to us in the early days of Krishna consciousness. We came as Mayavadis, and we didn't see any other way out. We had some little inkling, some little desire, and the devotees would confront us, you know, doing TN. You know, we were sitting here, and I remember sitting over there doing my meditation, you know, the whole thing. And the devotees would come up, oh, you're crazy, Mayavadi, you know, and all this kind of stuff. Bhavananda didn't do that, you know. He knew that we were somehow attached to this Maharishi guy, you know. And so he would say, oh, I've met Maharishi. Oh, really? Yeah. He's a very happy man. That's all he would say, you know. Oh, good. And that opened the way for him to give us more instruction. So you never ever confront. You actually
I'm just talking to you, I mean, like, you know, like getting someone to accept Krishna.
Okay. Any other comments or questions? Yes, Prabhu.
Is there a boy in the fellowship and a where
do you think that's going to be? Where's what? The interface conference. We're going to have some little flyer at GoPro. And I'll put one up here as well. And I have to organise with Brother Murray now. We only just got it over the weekend as to how to do the book table. And all the dates will be there, and we're looking for devotees to do a kirtan party and Pearson Road in Rye on the peninsula. You know, Mornington, Frankston, down that way. And all the major faiths. But then next year, there's an international interfaith symposium here in Melbourne. It's like the Olympics of religion. So the person that is the so-called representative of the Hindu community has said, hey, listen, this is too much for me. You guys get 10,000 Indians coming through, Hindus coming through to see your temple. Is there any way you can possibly help me? And that's Swami Sankarananda. And he said, can you possibly help me? And I said, yeah, I think we might be able to. So if we've given our own space, you know, you present his thing, you present our thing, and let the individual choose like that. So yeah, that's a big one coming up next year. And again, all of us have to be on our best preaching behaviour and get out there and really present the flow, present Christ. Any other questions?
Yeah.
I have to contact him. Yeah, I have to contact him. Very nice guy. He said, yeah, I've got the same doubts. Oh, good.
Anyway.
Shilpa Prabhupada.